it.
Morning, I would like to reserve 90 seconds if I can.
Okay, a minute and a half for rebuttal. Yes, sir.
My name is Jay Burns, Earl III, and I'm an attorney representing the appellate Kirk Milam. I'm going to focus on as many of the arguments that I've raised as I can. Time runs out. There are some that certainly are much more priority than others. I'm going to start with the Rappahannock County Circuit Court's error in the failure to reduce support and increasing support when there was not a motion before it by the appellee. The motion was filed on June 29, 2012, praying that the court reduce the award of child support and reduce or terminate spousal support, which was subsequently withdrawn. There was nothing about modification of child support raised by the appellant.
Mr. Earl, 20-108 states the court may, from time to time, after decreeing as provided in 2107.2, on petition of either the parents or on its own motion, revise support. Why can't the court on its own motion do this?
The court did not do it on its own motion.
Well, there was no motion by the wife, so it must have been on the court's motion.
Well, that would be an assumption that the court, if the court were doing it on its own motion.
I mean, the court calculated the child support using the worksheet, found that it required an increase, and did it. That's its own doing.
That might be its own doing, but if it's doing it on its own motion, that would have eliminated certain rights that the appellant would have had. And I think one is notice that the court's going to do that, because that took away at least a right to non-suit when the court did that. But this court did not do that. This court did not do that on its own motion, did not give any kind of notice that that's what
So what should the trial court have done when it calculated the presumptive child support as being over and above the current child support?
It would have looked at the pleadings and seen what the request was and followed what the law is in Fadden and said there was no request for anything but a reduction in child support.
Now Fadden is with spousal support.
There is
no corresponding provision in the child support statute regarding on its own the court on its own motion.
Correct, Your Honor, but in Fadden it says fundamental rules of pleading provide that no court can base its judgment or decree upon a right which has not been pleaded and claimed. So there had been no right by the appellee, there had been no notice by the court that he was going to take that. And I think even from the Potts case, no court can base its decree upon facts not alleged or render its judgment upon a right not meritorious.
But you would agree that your client, through you, obviously, filing a pleading put the parties at issue on the issue, correct? In other words, the issue was raised that we want a recalculation of this support obligation.
I would submit that, well, before I was involved, Mr. Milam filed a motion to reduce child support.
Okay, and inherent in that motion is a determination by the court to figure out what the appropriate child support obligation should be.
I would say that once that court determined that it was X number of dollars, he would have looked to either the appellant or the appellee and says, I have no pleading on you. I can't make that decision. I can't make the decision for you, to the appellant, because it's not the right decision. I cannot reduce it. So I'm going to deny your motion.
Doesn't that raise potential issues of either collateral estoppel or res judicata? You've got an issue that's filed before the court. The parties at issue is the determination of the child support obligation. Court says, well, you want it reduced to $500. I've done the calculation, and actually it suggested it should be increased to $650. You're saying then that collateral estoppel or res judicata would not preclude?
I don't think it would preclude the appellee from raising that issue. And one of the reasons why I think that is analysis in a juvenile court proceeding, they give separate numbers to the pleadings filing for child support for a father or a non-custodial parent versus a custodial parent. So I don't think that would she would be collaterally stopped.
But where does that leave the children? It's clear that in awarding child support, the most important consideration is the best interest of the children. And 2124.2 authorizes the court in its own motion to make such further decrees as shall be deemed expedient concerning the support of minor children. I mean, that's what concerns me. You're looking at this as a contest between husband and wife. The courts look at it as the interest of the child.
Yes, sir, and I understand that, but I guess in conjunction here is there was one less child to be concerned about.
I understand that, but the court, I mean, it's suppose the husband had won the lottery and he suddenly has a whole lot more money available to him. Should the children suffer because the mother fails to file a pleading?
Judge, I don't, it's interesting that you bring up the lottery question because I'll get back to that in a minute. But no, I think that the courts put her on notice that the child support is going to likely be raised. So I think that the court had said that was the motion that it was making before it could have stopped proceedings. She could have done what she wanted. But I think modification means making a limited change. Reduction means making something smaller, and that didn't occur in this case.
Let's move to some of your other issues, because you've got some interesting ones here, but I don't want to run out of time.
Judge, it's interesting that you raised the issue about lottery, which brings me into the second argument of the poverty level guidelines, including a child in the household size, which basically inflated the appellant's child support obligation.
Do you agree that the federal regulations leave it to the entity or agency that's applying the federal poverty guidelines to determine the size of the household?
I do.
So if, suppose this were an instance where the mother had living in her household a minor child of a previous marriage, is your argument that child would not be considered part of the household?
You're saying a child, as long as it's a child, I would agree. That
even though it's not the husband's child,
I would agree that child should be included. But I also think that there's some other things that should be looked at, and that is income in the household. I think there's some courts, I believe it's in Florida, that consider child support payments for that other child to be considered.
Suppose it is an elderly parent living in the mother's household. Is that person a part of the household, even if supported entirely by the mother?
Judge, I think there you've got to look at, if you can include that person in the household number, then you have to include her income in the household.
What is the standard of review for a judge's decision whether to include or exclude an individual as part of the household?
Judge, this has not been, I don't think this has ever been determined.
Wouldn't it be abuse of discretion?
Yes, sir. I believe it would be. But you raise a good point when you raise about the lottery. If her adult child had won the lottery and was sitting in the house and she was reaping the benefits of this child, 19-year-old having won the lottery, is it fair at that level to use the 150% poverty level guideline without consideration of the resources in that house that she's getting the benefit?
But even if the judge uses or determines that the income is below the 150% of poverty level, the judge still has the discretion as to whether to use the joint or sole custody guidelines, correct?
He does.
And isn't that the point the court would say, well, the other member of the household has got a huge income, it would be unjust for me to use the sole custody guideline?
That's possible. That we had other evidence that the appellant was exercising 134 days a year, one, and the reality of the situation is her income, without consideration of the other arguments that I've made, and I rely on my brief to raise that, income level for the mother fell down below.
Did the now 18-year-old child, 18 and a half year old child, was there any evidence that child had any income?
Judge, as I recall, I think he works sporadically. But I think that given the amount of the closeness to that threshold as to whether it was a sole custody or shared custody guideline, I think it would make a difference.
Let me ask you about your, I think your next is somewhat related assignment of error regarding the inclusion or exclusion of the spousal support payments. The order of the trial court awarded $1,380 a month in child support payments. Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay. The only worksheet that I could find in the record was Father's Exhibit 1 at App 546 that calculates out that amount of child support, $1,380. And that worksheet includes $2,830 a month in spousal support payments to the mother and excludes $2,830 of spousal support payments to the father. So even though I agree with you, the court said it wasn't going to include that amount. Apparently it did.
I don't believe it did, Your Honor, and I just...
Well, can you turn to App 546 and look at line 2 of that calculated worksheet?
Judge, I'm relying on what the court said it did, and I do not believe it did that.
Well, look at the child, the bottom line. Isn't that $1,380?
It is $1,380.
So even if the court said it was going to exclude that, isn't that harmless error in light of the fact that the spousal support is exactly what you claim it should be?
If that's what the facts are.
Well, there's no other spouse. Do you know of any other guideline worksheet in the record?
I think there's 2 or 3 in the record.
I didn't find any other than that one, but it's a pretty voluminous record. So if you could point me to one, I'd be glad to look at it.
I wish I could write down one, but I recognize.
Counsel, if you could switch gears a little bit to this due process concern that you raised. What is your view as to how the due process aspect of the judge essentially issuing an order saying that if wife files an affidavit that husband's done anything wrong, just go lock the husband up without any court hearing prior to the lockup. What is your view on that?
Well, my concern is that very much he is a court-appointed attorney, and that's clear throughout the case that he's a court-appointed attorney. And the Supreme Court could cut off the court-appointed funds because of a budget crisis at the end of the year, and he's going to have no means in which to say, I have to have some kind of relief.
Some might argue, though, that even though the trial judge's order may be somewhat overbroad, that the case isn't really ripe unless and until the circumstance that's been outlined in the order occurs. Wife files affidavit, says husband hasn't paid, husband's locked up. Then that would trigger the due process concern that you raised.
It could, Your Honor, but I would say that just the whole process of doing this by an affidavit is
But how do we know the court would follow through on that? How do we know that the trial court wouldn't have second thoughts about the constitutionality of that process and at the time the affidavit is filed say, I think I'd better give him notice and opportunity to be heard?
Well, that would be quite presumptive of me to determine what they
But that's my point. I mean, the trial courts sometimes say things or even put things in orders that when it comes time to carry them through, they realize they may have taken a step too far.
They speak through your orders, Your Honor. That's what I have to understand. And I understand that the appellant in small counties around Tanna County has to be concerned about being locked up, being...
If we agree with you on this, is the proper remedy simply to vacate that portion of the order? Could we just vacate that portion of the order?
Yes.
Thank you.
You're into your rebuttal time, counsel. You can use it as you see fit, or you could let Mr. Buffbauer explain why this problem from a due process standpoint should be one that we should be concerned with. Is the due process clause by its nature prescriptive? In other words, we want to get out in front of things before they occur?
I think we need to look at this in two ways. First, he has had due process already in the finding of contempt. He has had a full opportunity with notice and an opportunity to be heard, and the court went ahead and imposed the punishment.
But if wife files an affidavit, he hasn't had an opportunity. opportunity, notice and an opportunity to be heard on what wife says.
As I understand the order, at that point in time, a capias would issue, and he would be remanded to the custody of the sheriff to serve his sentence. There's nothing in that, and perhaps it's a little overbroad, but there's nothing in that in and of itself that indicates when a capias is issued, which is what happens frequently in probation revocations.
Well, is this criminal contempt or is this civil contempt?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the judge didn't say what it was.
There's nothing in the order that would allow the husband to purge the contemptuous behavior.
Well, it seems to me that the purpose behind the suspension of the sentence was to give him an opportunity to pay.
Was there a definite time imposed?
There's a definite schedule of when his payments.
No, is there a definite period of incarceration imposed?
Yes.
Well, isn't that a criminal contempt?
No, because civil contempt, I think you couldn't go more than 12 months at a pop anyway.
Isn't the safest thing here to be to vacate this portion, let the trial judge exercise his authority over the case by following the traditional way of citing someone for contempt as opposed to letting the wife have a self-effectuating contempt power?
That would be one way of handling it. At the same time, Mr. Earl makes a good argument about he's a small attorney, he's a court-appointed attorney in a small jurisdiction. Well, because he's an attorney in that jurisdiction, we've had a judge designate who's now a retired judge, but still retaining the case. It is exceedingly difficult if he does not comply, depending on whether or not the presiding judge, who's now retired, will still hear the case.
And come back.
Or else it has to come all the way back, and another judge gets appointed, and we could go months without her or the children receiving any support.
But the husband could go months sitting in the local Huskow, waiting for the judge to review his contempt finding.
I believe he would have a right to an opportunity to appear before a judge quicker than we are going to get a judge to go ahead and adjudicate the child support issue.
Let me ask you something on the issue of whether the spousal support should be included for calculation purposes in the worksheet. We have opined in Cranwell versus Cranwell that the trial court errs by not including spousal support that was actually paid.
Right.
We ducked the issue or did not have to address the issue of whether to include ordered but unpaid child support.
Right. And
so my question is this, in looking at the record, it appears to me that the husband was ordered to pay $2,830 a month for spousal support and $1,170 a month for child support. Given taking the wife's figures at face value, in 2013 he paid $40,000, which is almost $26,000 above the child support payments. And in 2014 he paid $26,000, which was $15,006 over and above the child support payments. Shouldn't those amounts have been included in the worksheet under Cranwell?
They were included. Regardless of what the judge says, you were correct in pointing out that the worksheet upon which he relied in determining the support did actually include the full amount, even though it had not been.
But you agree the trial court erred, at least in its order, when it said, I'm not including any spousal support payment.
I think as long as there is evidence that there are payments made, and I think in the case you alluded to, those payments were sporadic, but they were being made. When payments are being made, even if they are sporadic, there should be inclusion. But in a situation where there are no payments at all, though ordered for some period of time, I don't think it would be error for the court not to include
them. We haven't addressed that issue,
right,
as far as I can tell, and I wrote Cranwell, so I can tell you I researched it pretty thoroughly.
And you know, I think the issue that gives me greatest concern for you all to address, frankly, from a practice perspective, is this issue about household size. This is not, courts come down all over the place on the household size issue. It is an issue of first impression and would be nice for practitioners to have some guidance on what it is. believe that the
That's code for saying you want a published opinion, correct?
Well, it doesn't matter, whatever you all want to do. It's not for me to say whether you publish them or not, Judge. The reality of the situation is, there's a lot of confusion, and there's a reference, and here I don't believe it's an abuse of error standard. I think you see this is a matter of statutory interpretation, which
well,
you need to know about.
The statutory construction is solely related to the interpretation of the regulation as to who applies, who determines, and under what criteria size of household.
Right, and the problem, Judge, is that while other agencies rely on those guidelines and have regulations and guidelines to say how they include or don't include individuals, the agency that has to make that determination is the courts. And there are no regulations that tell us, so you have a disparity of result and the possibility of this situation. I think the judge handled it correctly. If you're in the house, you're in the house and you're counted. I don't disagree with counsel that if you're in the house and you have an income, your income's counted.
Well, now, if mother is living with her boyfriend after the divorce, would the trial court have to include the boyfriend is part of the household?
My view would be if he is living there, he's included as part of the household. All that gets you to is the question of the 150% federal poverty limit. That does
what
not.
What if the trial court says, wait a minute, a house, by using size of household, the regulation assumes that the mother in this case has some obligation, moral or otherwise, to support that person? I mean, isn't that a logical interpretation?
I don't believe that would be correct as an interpretation. I recently had a case where we had this, and the mother had remarried. So her husband's living in the household. I mean,
well, there is some moral obligation that the wife contribute to the well-being of the husband, and
yeah,
vice versa.
Do we really, I'm not sure that we want to lay down a rule with regard to size of household that's going to depend on the marital status.
But once we decide the regulation, our statutory construction of the regulation assigns to the trial court the authority to define size or to decide size of household, isn't that decision then reviewed under abuse of discretion? How the court decides to
yes.
apply that?
Yes, and I think what's important to remember and why it really has little bearing here other than the threshold to say, is the shared custody guideline presumptive? That's all that this 150% of federal poverty guideline does. It allows a court to say that guideline's not presumptive. It does not bar the court from applying the shared custody guideline.
Well, it allows the court to decide which guideline to utilize. Shared or,
right.
or sold.
It then has discretion, which would be
so another abuse of discretion. So isn't your better argument here that we don't need to decide whether boyfriends or new husband or anybody else is part of the household, because here we clearly have a young child or young adult, I guess, that has just reached adulthood, and there certainly is a moral, if not legal, obligation for the mother in this case to provide support for the child.
I think in this case that would be correct. That's
best in their
the law of this case, that would be fine. As a practitioner, would love to have a little bit more guidance because this issue comes
Those
up.
Those are called more, advisory opinions.
Yeah, well, more frequently than you might imagine.
But wouldn't we have, in this instance, a more consistent application of what we're talking about if we allow the feds to ultimately make the call on this, similar to what they do in quadros that need to be approved by the feds? The feds essentially set the standards, and we're stuck with the standards, obviously.
Right, but they don't define it. That's the problem. If they do not define the concept of household size, depending on the federal agency applying those guidelines, they include or exclude various individuals who may or may not live in a house.
Well, suppose we just, it's an undefined term, household.
Right.
Why don't we just apply the common meaning of the term household, which Black's dictionary says is a, A household is a family living together. What's wrong with that definition?
I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
And then we'll let the trial court decide who's in the family and who's not.
I don't think there's any problem with that.
And then use the abuse of discretion standard that the judge makes a determination that obviously it makes no sense or is inconsistent with reasonable interpretation, that's fine.
Right, let's say mother lives at the house and has three roommates, and she wants to include the three roommates as being part of the household. Maybe that is and maybe that isn't, and leave it to the judge to decide.
Well, if we use the term family, family is not boyfriends, roommates.
Right.
Family is kin.
But the guidelines reference in the statute refer to household, not to family. So.
Well, it uses doesn't the guideline talk about both family and household, family or household member? Family slash household.
By saying family or household member, obviously household would be a larger grouping of individuals under the roof than family, it would seem to me. So it's purposely done by HHS to be broad, but in our cases, we need to have some clarity to know where to go with it. The last point that I would like to make, unless you all have any other questions, Your Honors, is that this question about the motion to reduce, a reduction, like an increase, is a modification. When you ask somebody to change it, you're asking them to modify. I don't believe under the statute, you put it in an issue, and you understand what the rules are. The rules, when you say there's a change, the rules are we need to reapply the guideline and determine a number and see what the presumptive amount is. That's what the black letter law says. And so when you come in and you say reduce, you understand that's a modification.
Could the trial court do the calculations, come up with an amount of child support that is in excess of currently paid child support, and then deviate with the reason being mom didn't ask for any increase?
Could the trial court do it? Yes. Would I appeal and suggest this an abuse of discretion? I would. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
All right, counsel, you have about a minute.
Judge, just very quickly, I would refer the court to 108.2b when talking about children in the household. It says number of children means the number of children for whom the parents share joint legal responsibility and for whom support is being sought. To me, that eliminates the 19-year-old kid, or adult son. Judge, I also want to discuss the calculation of income. Here, the court abused its discretion going through 7 months of deposits, double counting garnished income that it found, and coming up with an income of $185,000 that was about double of the tax return from 2007. Through 2011 and the 2012 tax return, almost double for a court-appointed attorney. Furthermore, I also would argue that the motion to reduce was filed 2 years before it was heard. If the court didn't have jurisdiction of it at that time when the case was here, I question whether the court could hear it at all. Could the court actually pick that up later and hear that motion at all?
Counsel, your time has expired. I'll give you 30 seconds or so to sum up if you'd like.
Judge, I'd ask the court to just, I'd like to rely on my brief, my reply brief. I think I have enunciated pretty clearly what's in there. As far as the household members, I would say that to the court that for that issue, it is very important to our case, because I think it would raise the level of mother above what the HHS says is her income, and that would affect whether the presumptive, which guideline is presumptive.
All right, thank you, counsel. Come back to recounsel.